evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Law School. My name is Carolyn Evans. I'm the Dean of the School, and on behalf of my colleagues and our students, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the first of our public lectures, and it's such a delight to see so many people here tonight. I begin by acknowledging that we meet on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Tonight we meet for the 2012 Peter Brett Memorial Lecture, which will be delivered by Mrs. Fatou Bensouda on the topic, The Rome Statute 10 Years On, Where To For Here, from the International Court of Justice. Before I introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, I just would like to give you a little bit of background to the Peter Brett Memorial Lecture. In 2007, two generous anonymous donors made this lecture series possible, and I'd also like to thank the Brett family for their continued support of the series. It's named for Professor Peter Brett, who was a long-term member of the faculty here, moving from a senior lecturer in law in 1955 to reader in 61, the Hearn Professor of Law at the University of Melbourne from 1963 to 64, and the Professor of Jurisprudence from 1964 until his death in 1975. Professor Brett was a very distinguished scholar. He was a scholar of criminal law and jurisprudence. He was a fiercely intellectual scholar, but he was also someone who believed in the importance of the practical application of the scholarly work. To give just one example of many activities of this kind, he was one of a group of lawyers who stopped the hanging of Paul Tait in 1962, creating a landmark in the history of capital punishment in Australia. We'd like to welcome any members of the audience who may have taught with or studied under Professor Brett, and we'd like to extend a special welcome to the Brett family who are here tonight. We're delighted to welcome his sons, Jonathan, Robin and David Brett, and their wives, Karen, Jane and Catherine, Peter's daughter, Margaret Warren, and his two granddaughters, Georgina and Joanna Brett, who are with us tonight. You are very welcome here. Let me turn now to introduce our speaker tonight, and we are very grateful to her for making the trip to Melbourne, especially to be with us. She's been here at Sydney participating in a conference there. Mrs. Fatou Bensouda is at the moment Deputy Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and she was appointed there in 2004. She has been elected to succeed the current prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, when his nine-year term expires midway through this year. Prior to her taking up her appointment at the international level, she held a number of senior government positions in the Gambia in West Africa. Between 1987 and 1993, for example, she was successively public prosecutor, state senior counsel, and principal state counsel. She subsequently served as deputy director of public prosecutions, solicitor general, and legal secretary of the Gambia prior to her appointment as attorney general and Minister for Justice. As you can see, somebody who's had an extraordinarily distinguished career, both in her own country and also internationally. She also has acted as senior legal advisor and head of the legal advisory unit of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. It is 10 years since the establishment of the International Criminal Court. It is a very appropriate time to stop and reflect on the court, the challenges of the future, and the difficulties in consolidating the current cases before the ICC, seven of which involve African countries. There are many challenges. We couldn't think of a more qualified person to come and speak to us tonight. We're very grateful to her for coming. I'd like to particularly thank my colleague, Professor Tim McCormack, who's been a special advisor to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and who has helped arrange this lecture along with our colleagues from the Military Law Centre. Professor McCormack will chair question time, and we're particularly grateful to you for being prepared to take questions, Mrs. Bensouda, and we'll also, on all of our behalfs, thank the speaker at the end of the evening. I would now call on Mrs. Fatou Bensouda to deliver the 2012 Peter Brett Memorial Lecture.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And thank you for this kind invitation from the University of Melbourne Law School. Before I start, I would like to give special thanks to the university and the Melbourne Law School for so generously allowing the Office of the Prosecutor to make use of the services and the extensive experience and knowledge of Professor Tim McCormack. As special advisor of the prosecutor on international humanitarian law, His contribution has been critical to the office, and most recently, when he participated in the closing arguments with me in our first case, the prosecutor versus Thomas Lubanga. Today, I would like to share with you some reflections in relation to the International Criminal Court, a unique institution of which I have the privilege of being the deputy prosecutor since 2004, as well as the next prosecutor come June 2012. And I would like to discuss with you how the work of the court can contribute to the prevention of massive crimes. Crimes that we thought over and over again would never happen again, only to see them occur again and again before our eyes. Genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. I would like to discuss with you how the preventive impact of our work could be maximized, how we can stop the current genocide in Darfur, how can we prevent a new cycle of violence, the next elections in Kenya, scheduled in 2013. How can we support Colombia, their efforts to end half a century of violence? And I would like to say one word, institutions. In our countries, the Congress, the police, the prosecutors, and the courts are the basic institutions to establish and enforce law and order. The Rome Statute, which establishes the ICC, is building the same idea, but is doing so internationally. Judicial institutions are created to contribute to prevent and manage massive violence. 60 years ago, with the Nuremberg trials, for the first time, those who committed massive crimes were held accountable before the international community. And for the first time, the victors of a conflict chose the law to define responsibilities. Nuremberg was a landmark. However, the world was not ready to transform such a landmark into a lasting institution. And in the end, the world would wait for almost half a century later, after Nuremberg, and would witness again two genocides, first in the former Yugoslavia and then in Rwanda, before the United Nations Security Council decided to create the International Criminal Court, Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, thus connecting peace and international justice again. The ad hoc tribunals paved the way for the decision of the international community to establish a permanent criminal court, to avoid a repetition of past experiences, a court built upon the lessons of decades when the world had failed to prevent massive crimes. The Rome Statute establishing the International Criminal Court added an independent and permanent justice component to the world's efforts to achieve peace and security. The Rome Statute offers a solution, creating a global governance without a global government, but with international law and courts. Accountability and the rule of law provide the framework to protect individuals and nations from massive atrocities and to manage conflicts. In 1998, this was just an idea on paper. In 2012, today, we have put it in motion. The International Criminal Court has become a recognized institution that is part of the international landscape. The unanimous referral by the UN Security Council of the situation in Libya in 2011, which included the positive votes from five non-states parties, is a confirmation of that. Excuse me. And it makes clear that the Rome Statute consolidates a new trend. And this trend is no more impunity for alleged perpetrators of massive crimes. In the Rome Statute community, leaders using massive violence to gain or retain power will be held accountable. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to first give you a proper understanding of how the Rome system is put in motion. One of the main principles of the statute is that all states' parties commit to investigate, prosecute, and prevent massive crimes when perpetrated within their own jurisdiction. 120 states today have accepted that. And should they fail in this primary responsibility to investigate and prosecute, the ICC can independently decide to step in. Under the principle of complementarity, proceedings before the ICC as a court of last resort should remain an exception to the norm. Under the Rome Statute, state parties also commit to cooperate with the court whenever and wherever the court decides to act. The court can therefore rely on the cooperation of the police of all states' parties to implement its decisions. And this is not just an abstraction. Cooperation with the court is a fact. The Democratic Republic of Congo has already surrendered 3 of their nationals to the court. The Belgian police implemented in one day an arrest warrant against Jean-Pierre Bemba, a former vice president of the Democratic Republic of Congo. France, cooperating with Rwanda and the court, did the same with regards to Calixte Mbarushimana, executive secretary of the Force Démocratique pour la Libération du Rwanda, the FDLR. Ladies and gentlemen, fully respecting the legal requirements, the Office of the Prosecutor has opened investigations and brought cases in 7 situations: Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, Darfur, Libya, and Cote d'Ivoire. The office focuses its investigations on those who bear the greatest responsibility for the most serious crimes in accordance with the evidence collected. Focusing on those most responsible is the way to maximize the preventive impact of the court's intervention. It is up to states to deal with other perpetrators. All the cases presented by the office so far have been against the top leaders of the organizations involved in the commission of crimes, including 3 heads of state. And following its specific duty to focus on gender crimes and crimes against children, the office's first case, Thomas Lubanga, which is seeing its judgment soon, exposed how boys and girls were abused as child soldiers, how they were trained to kill and to rape, and how they themselves were raped. And each subsequent case has highlighted a further aspect of gender crimes, from the command responsibility asserted for an organized campaign of rapes in the case against Jean-Pierre Bemba in the Central African Republic, to the charges of genocide through rape against President al-Bashir in Darfur. The gravity threshold in all these cases is very high. In each situation, there were hundreds or thousands of persons killed and raped, and in many, millions were displaced. The cases before the court are indeed the most serious crimes of concern to the international community. The office is also engaged in preliminary examinations in various situations around the world. The office is analyzing crime in Honduras, Republic of Korea, Afghanistan, and Nigeria. It is checking if genuine national proceedings are being carried out in Guinea, Colombia, and Georgia, and it is assessing the declaration accepting the jurisdiction of the court by the Palestinian National Authority. During these examinations, these preliminary examinations, the office makes public announcements of the beginning of an activity and is able to send missions and also request for information from national governments. This information can be factored in by all states and relevant organizations in timely accountability efforts at the national level. The court today is truly in motion and is fully operational. After starting operations in 2003, when the first prosecutor of the court took office, we have now arrived at a crucial juncture in the history of this young global institution, the closing of its first trials. This will be fundamental to complete the judicial cycle. It will be fundamental to reinforce the legal system of the court and also to give it more legitimacy as we continue our work. It will also allow us to even be more efficient and effective in conducting judicial proceedings as the jurisprudence established by the judges and the police and the best practices produced by our investigative and prosecutorial experiences will have helped us to do our work better and faster. But the true relevance of these trials, as well as of other activities of the office, will more importantly lie on the fact that by their global impact, they will contribute to the prevention of recurring violence. Indeed, one court's ruling affects a multiplicity of cases. And this is what the Secretary General of the United Nations has referred to as the shadow of the court. And this shadow should be considered as the most important impact of the court. What is the shadow of the court first trial of the International Criminal Court? Our first trial, Thomas Lubanga Dilo, even before the final decision, has helped triggering debates on child recruitment in remote countries like Colombia or Sri Lanka, and child soldiers were in fact released in Nepal. The Special Representative of the United Nations Secretary General on Children in Armed Conflicts immediately factored in such potential and used us as a tool to campaign around the world and secure even more releases. This is an example of how to use the law to prevent crimes. The Lubanga ruling could change the life of little boys and girls. Never again should they be left out of the assistance provided by the demobilization programs, and never again should they be used as fighters or as sexual slaves. The Lubanga judgment will also be an opportunity to focus on how states and other relevant actors can contribute to justice through national education curricula. This interest of the Office of the Prosecutor was expressed in our prosecutorial strategy of 2009 to 2012, that education, as one of the fundamental means to maximize the impact of the work of the court and to contribute to the prevention of future crimes. The office aims to encourage the inclusion in students' curricula of information about the past conflicts and global issues, such as child soldiers, the functioning of global institutions and methods and skills to manage violence at domestic and international level. The office is helping by connecting countries and actors interested and by providing information related with its own activities. In the second trial, which is ongoing, in the case of the prosecutor versus Germain Katanga and Matthew Ngujolo-Chui, The closing oral arguments will be made by the parties on the 15th of May. And the closing of this trial also, which focuses on the militia group that was fighting with Thomas Lubanga, will help to bring accountability and reconciliation in the Ituri region of the Democratic Republic of Congo and will further contribute to the pacification of the region. In our third trial, I've mentioned Jean-Pierre Bemba, the office is currently finishing the presentation of our case. And this is the first time for the international criminal justice system to address a situation where the allegations of sexual crimes far outnumber the allegations of killings. And it is for the first time, it is also the first trial before the court that concerns command responsibility. A commander's failure to act can result in unimaginable atrocities that deeply shock the conscience of humanity. In this case, Bemba clearly failed his responsibility to stop and prevent militia forces from using rape as a primary weapon of war. In terms of impact, this trial is an opportunity. Like any other criminal court, the judges will decide Jean-Pierre Bemba's individual criminal responsibility. But the preventive aspect of the trial, its forward-looking aspect, has no precedent. Unlike any other court, the ICC's decision will influence the behavior of thousands of military commanders from the 120 states parties. The ICC's decision will enforce a law adopted by states parties and will make a difference. The difference between a military commander and a criminal is respect for the law. And finally, our prosecutions in Kenya, where charges have been confirmed against 4 out of 6 suspects. This, we believe, will help support the process of structural reforms in the country and prevent violence during the next presidential elections. We hope also that they will serve as a deterrent in other presidential elections across the world, putting political leaders on notice. If they use massive violence to gain or to retain power, the message is that they will be prosecuted. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe this is the way forward. We can see the effect of the court's activities in practice. It is affecting the behavior of governments and political leaders, and armies all over the world are adjusting their operational standards. Conflict managers and peace mediators are refining their strategy, taking into account the work of the court, respecting the legal limits. The Rome Statute is extending, building a network of actors around the world to maximize the prevention of massive crimes and enforcing common standards in situations where massive crimes falling within its jurisdiction are committed. In Rome, states made a conscious decision to create a justice system that could stop or prevent violence rather than an ad hoc creation which is acting after the fact. New rules were created and other actors must adjust to it. The court is modifying the dynamics of the United Nations model without actually changing the rules. The United Nations Charter envisaged a collective security system to maintain international peace and security. And this was a huge advance, but it left all the critical decisions in the hands of politics. With the adoption of the Rome Statute model, state parties shifted the paradigm from the Westphalia model of national self-regulation to the United Nations model of international scrutiny under the UN Security Council supervision to the Rome Statute model of the rule of law. Be it because of principles or self-interest, they adopted a rule of law paradigm. They agreed to respect the decisions of an independent and permanent international criminal court. They are determined to ensuring lasting peace and respect for and the enforcement of international justice. And step by step, the Rome Statute system is moving ahead and it's creating a new international dynamic, impacting other institutions and changing international relations forever. As the next prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, I will continue to contribute to solidifying this change, and I hope I can continue to count on all of your support. All of you present here today, as future leaders, future world leaders, I hope I can continue to count on you to achieve this change. And I thank you for your patience.
Thanks very much, Mrs. Bensouda, for such a great overview of the current work of the court and a little insight into your own passions and commitment to the activities you're engaged in. Let's take some questions and comments from the floor. There will undoubtedly be some. There are roving mics on either aisle, and we'll ask you please to stand and identify yourself and your affiliation and then your question. Perhaps we'll start over here, Ryan, if that's okay.
Yes, thanks very much. I'm Nancy Atkin and I work for the Medical Association for Prevention of War. Our organisation is concerned with events such as the anniversary of the 1914-18 war coming up in Australia. Our government and weapons manufacturers are putting a lot of money into romanticising and mythologising the history of that war rather than asking just how we came to invade Turkey as an independent country. And I'm very interested in that respect in your work on education, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that and what sort of resources might be available for us. Thanks.
This is an idea that we have been developing. It's actually quite recent. Since last year, maybe we began to be more serious about seeing how we can talk to universities or schools to even see whether it is possible to put it in the curriculum of schools to teach what is happening at the international level, what the International Criminal Court's work is all about. So currently there is a project that the prosecutor, the Lewis, the current prosecutor, is working on with the Hague with the mayor who is promoting this idea, and it's a project that hopefully will take off. I think towards the end of this year, and as I said, the idea is to promote even at a very young age, if this is possible, not just higher institutions of learning, but even at a very young, at the primary school level, to see whether this can be introduced. And students will know about what this is all about how they can, from a very young age, also be aware of the work of the International Criminal Court and international criminal justice in general.
Let's come down to the front to you first, and then we'll come here, and then we'll come to the other side.
Thank you very much. I have three questions. One, the situation in Uganda was referred to the International Criminal Court, but I know that the Rome Statute came into force in 2002, but many of the heinous crimes were committed prior to the year the ICC came into force, and now they're matters of retrospectivity. How is the ICC dealing with such situations? Because I know that the most heinous crimes were committed prior to 2002. So how is the court dealing with that kind of situation? Okay. Two, what is the ICC doing in as far as the situation in Iraq is concerned?
In?
Is the court investigating the situation in Iraq?
In Iraq?
Yes, because okay. I believe various war crimes and crimes against humanity were committed.
Yeah.
by the respective forces, which everybody knows. So what is the ICC doing about this situation? Because some critics of the court have said that, in fact, the ICC is not a court. It's a court with eyes. Yeah, that is why it's able to see crimes in Africa, but it's not able to see crimes which are committed by other states other than African states.
Okay. Can I take the two? Yeah. With respect to Uganda, ICC was established in 2002. So our temporal jurisdiction starts from 2002. That is our mandate. Any crime that took place prior to 2002, we do not have the jurisdiction to look into it. So I think that is an issue that the Uganda government itself will have to deal with it. But we are not able to go below or beyond before 2002. But with respect to Uganda itself, you know that we have investigated. I think that was one of our fastest investigations. We've investigated and issued arrest warrants against Joseph Kony and the top leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army. Since 2005, I believe, and up to now, those warrants have not been executed. Joseph Kony is still at large. He has moved from Uganda to Sudan to Central African Republic, and now we believe that he is in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in the Garamba Park, and he continues to commit crimes. I think more efforts should be made in arresting Joseph Kony, at least, and surrendering him to the ICC. With respect to your second question about Iraq, the jurisdiction of the ICC is such that we have jurisdiction over in territories of state parties or over nationals of state parties. In the case of Iraq, we have made some analysis. We don't have jurisdiction, first, because Iraq is not a state party. However, some of those who were involved in the conflict are state parties, therefore they are nationals of state parties. And what we have done is we've collected information and made analysis, and we have found out that in most cases, either those crimes are being investigated and prosecuted by the nationals themselves, which means that if that is happening, the ICC cannot look at it unless those were not genuine proceedings, or it hasn't reached the gravity threshold to require the intervention of ICC. All of this is actually put in our website explaining all that we have done in the case of Iraq. But normally we don't have jurisdiction because Iraq is not a state party. We were not able to collect information or do anything also with respect to the US, because US is also not a state party. But those other nationals who have signed and ratified the Rome Statute, we have been able to make analysis of their actions in Iraq.
Thanks. I'm going to just come to the front here, and then we'll go to the other side of the room. Just a reminder, please, to identify yourself before you ask your question.
Yes, Mrs. Bensuada, your contribution to humanity is deeply appreciated by my children, my children's children. It's an immense contribution at the court and yourself. I'm Glenn Floyd, a director of ICC Action, working with several community members, including National Past President of the Liberal Party of Australia. We led a brief of evidence to the court in 2007 to get John Winston Howard of Milne Avenue, Wollstonecroft, New South Wales, into the criminal court, and we hope to see him before you for your judicial analysis in the future. We received a letter back from the Chief Prosecutor in 2010 stating that the conduct described in our communication does not appear to fall within the court's mandate. We've been advised the brief of evidence is kept on file, it's legitimate, has not been rejected, and we've been invited to bring further evidence, which we will post Chilcot inquiry in Britain in the middle of the year. Can you tell me, is it the severity of the crime in Iraq with the heads of state, USA, UK, Australia, that does not warrant examination, or is it some other means just simply a snapshot of what is the reason that those heads of state, particularly Australia, who has signed the statute under Article 8, under the jus in bello paradigm that we brought this case, has not been, won't be examined.
As I was explaining to before about our intervention, gravity is a criteria that we use, the gravity of the crimes. And by that, we do not mean the number of people killed. There are many criteria that we use, including the impact that it will have, the nature of the crime, the methods used to commit the crime. All of these are used in analyzing whether it is grave enough to warrant the intervention of the court. And based on our analysis, we come to a conclusion, you know, whether to intervene or not. In the case of Iraq, again, coming to Iraq, we have looked at those countries, as I said, that are members of the ICC, that have signed and ratified the Rome Statute individually, not together, but individually, and to see either whether the crimes that have been committed has reached that gravity threshold, or whether anything is being done by the state themselves to address those crimes. I do not have the details with me here, but I can tell you that in each of them, it is either it is being addressed or the threshold was not reached. And because of that, we did not intervene.
Let's go to you in this third row, please, Anna.
Hi, my name's Layla. I'm a former student of Melbourne Uni. I'm now a lawyer. I noticed that you mentioned that you're considering the application by the Palestinian National Authority. And it's been, I guess, almost 3 years since they made that application. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if there's, can you comment at all on what considerations you're taking into account or where this is heading, when a decision might be made in relation to that? And I guess whether it would also impact the question of Palestine as a state for the purposes of Article 12. Thanks.
That issue did arise, of course, whether Palestine can actually make a declaration under the statute. Because if you look at the statute, it talks about when a state makes a declaration. What we did at the office was to open it up and invite a lot of people to come in, interested people from Palestine, from academia, everybody, and we held the debate at the office. We are continuously receiving information. At some point, we did not go ahead because Palestine requested us to hold on because they wanted to submit another report to show that, you know, this is a case that the ICC can take up. As you know, those who are arguing that Palestine is not a state and therefore cannot make a declaration under Article 12 is one camp. But the other camp is also saying that if you allow if you construe strictly the article by saying that only a state can make this declaration, therefore places like Palestine will be excluded and you will create this impunity zone. So these arguments, everything is on board. I think we already received the last report from the, not yet. We still have another report that we're waiting for from the Palestinian Authority. And of course, you know all that is happening, that is taking place at the United Nations regarding the situation in Palestine. We will receive the report, you know, we will consult again widely on it, and then we'll see. It's not easy to say that in 2 months we'll make a decision. It It will depend.
Hi, my name is Yaya. I come from Darfur, Western Sudan. We as Darfurian and as a part of Sudan, we welcome you to Melbourne. We wish you a good time in Melbourne City, and we hope you a happy trip on your way to home. The ICC has issued warrants for four senior Sudanese officials, President Omar al-Bashir, former Humanitarian Affairs Minister and current Governor of Nuba Mountains, Ahmad Haroun, Janjaweed Militia Leader Ali Kweshef, and Defense Minister Abdurahim Mohamed Hussein. All four men are accused for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. My question is, when can ICC bring those men to justice? Because of the failure to arrest those men has caused more suffering for the people in Sudan, especially women and children who continue to be victims of assault, murder, rape, and other horrendous crimes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for welcoming me. The situation in Darfur, as you know, was referred to the ICC by the United Nations Security Council. As you know, Sudan is not a state party, so ICC could not, the jurisdiction of ICC could not be triggered apart from through the United Nations Security Council. We have investigated, and we, as you have rightly said, four people have already been indicted. ICC was set up in such a way that we do our investigations, our judicial work, but the obligation to arrest is on states. States should arrest and surrender persons wanted by the ICC to the ICC. In the case of Sudan, as I said, it's not a state party. What we could do is to report back to the United Nations Security Council and say that Sudan is not cooperating with the ICC. In fact, when the case was referred to the ICC, Sudan publicly declared that they were not going to cooperate with the ICC. So arresting Bashir has been a challenge, as you know, since the warrants were issued. It has been a challenge. And even those states that have signed and ratified, we have seen examples of how Kenya, for example, had received Bashir. When Kenya has an obligation to arrest Bashir and surrender them. So this is where we are. We do not have a police. ICC doesn't have a police. ICC doesn't have an army to arrest individuals. It was set up in a way that the police and army of states will arrest these individuals. I think it just has to be serious that these persons who are sought by ICC should be arrested and surrendered. It's difficult. It's difficult, but I believe that it will happen sooner or later.
Perhaps you should also just mention, Fratu, that those arrest warrants for each of those named accused will have no statute of limitations applicable to them, and they will continue to be operative for the rest of, in Omar al-Bashir's case, his life, if he's not taken into custody. That's very important to actually keep
Absolutely.
In mind.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go up. There's not thousands, that's an exaggeration. there are literally dozens of hands. We'll go to a different part of the room, and I'll invite Reverend Professor Michael Tate to ask a question. So if we could have the microphone about, here he is, he's standing up already. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Michael Tate from the University of Tasmania Law School. May I offer my congratulations on your election, it's fantastic. I was fascinated by the paradigm shift you spoke about from political determination to rule of law in these matters. But isn't it a fact that the Security Council retains a right to defer a prosecution indefinitely, year by year? Yeah. Secondly, I was wondering whether the Security Council Permanent Five are entirely happy with the prospect of the crime of aggression coming into your practical jurisdiction in, what, 5 or 6 years' time. How do you see that that particular crime being dealt with at the ICC? Will the paradigm shift you speak of really be allowed to work?
With respect to the crime of aggression, for me, it's a crime that will come within the jurisdiction of the court if we get the 60 ratifications. And our intention is that this is the law. This is what, you know, what is in the statute, and this will be applied. Just like we're applying the crimes of we're charging crimes of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. If aggression comes, we will address it. As an office, because as you know, this is our limitation, the statute. This is what it asks us to do.
Yep. We go up to just behind the camera. Yeah, you're a lucky person, you're chosen one. Stand up and the microphone will come.
Hi, my name's Natasha and I go to the McRobertson Girls High School. And I'm currently studying global politics. So as a more general question, do you think the United States will ever ratify the Rome Statute? And should the US continue to not ratify the statute, what effect do you think this will have on the international law enforcement efforts of the ICC?
I cannot speak for the US. but you know, I think ICC, today we have 120 states that have signed and ratified the Rome Statute. And I believe we're expecting some ratifications even this year. But the point I want to make is that ICC's jurisdiction, smaller states, let me put it this way, smaller states seek protection under the ICC statute. In the sense that if a smaller state signs and ratifies the Rome Statute, the ICC can have jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction at least. And that is why I think that maybe we may not get the big powers to sign and ratify the Rome Statute soon. But I think that the more we get the smaller parties, smaller states, or less powerful states, to sign and ratify, we'll still give ICC jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction at least. Of course, the aim is to have universality. You know, this is what should happen. But for various reasons and policies, states who think that they shouldn't ratify now are not ratifying the Rome Statute. But this should not stop ICC from being effective. I think even currently, with our record, and the fact that I mentioned the unanimous decision by the UN Security Council to refer Libya to the ICC, shows that ICC, there is a possibility of ICC working everywhere, you know, operating, having jurisdiction everywhere. There is that possibility. But of course, there are other considerations.
Yeah. All right, we're going to go right up the back under the exit sign, possibly in an illegal spot if the fire brigade saw it, but it's okay.
My name is Alpha. I'm from Darfur. I just have a very quick question. I know that your restraint is to indict the sitting president, which is very good, but then the weakness is that you can't really go and capture someone who you indicted, and that for me as someone from Darfur, I've seen that the President al-Bashir, who has been indicted, actually he committed crimes after the indictment. Yes. And also the same minister, Ali Harun, who was indicted before al-Bashir, yeah. He was taken from Darfur and then given a job in Nuba Mountains, and where also he recently committed a lot of crimes. Yeah. So the fact that you can issue arrest warrant and you cannot arrest them. Mm-hmm. Me as the victim, I really see the big weakness for the ICC. Mm-hmm. And now my question is now, is there any strategy that you can strengthen your position to the point where if you indicted a president, you can just go on and capture him. Now, the following question is that I hear that the African Union is lobbying with another African countries to have you withdraw arrest warrant from Omar al-Bashir. And I don't know, would you consider doing that if you get as powerful pressure from China, from Russia, and from all African continents? Will you consider doing that? Yeah. The last question is, the people, al-Bashir is going to all countries, like he's visiting countries, even the countries that are party to the Rome Statutes, like Egypt, Ethiopia, and Chad. Now the question is here, what is the punishment of the countries that are breaching their commitment to the Rome Statutes?
The ICC, the way the ICC has been set to operate, I always say that ICC is not a court. It is, the Rome system is an international criminal justice system. Maybe that is the best way to describe it. And ICC is at the very center of this criminal justice system. And the under the Rome Statute, the mandate of the ICC is very clear. But also the obligations and duties of states who have signed and ratified the Rome Statute is also there, and that is executing the decisions of the ICC, including arresting and surrendering to the ICC. I know it's very frustrating that we issue arrest warrants and then there are all these problems for executing the arrest warrants. But under the current status of how the statute is, this is just how it is. We don't have powers of arrest. We cannot arrest. We don't even have the capacity. And this was how it was set up. With respect to Bashir, your question about whether we can just go and arrest a president, I don't think that is possible, even if we had an international force. You know, I don't think that is possible to go to a country and then just pick up the president and take them. In Sudan, with respect to Bashir, we have received a lot of suggestions and maybe even criticism that we should have sealed the warrants. Therefore, we would be able to get Bashir when he travels. But Bashir is a head of state. You know, he's a head of state. When he visits, he doesn't go on a frolic of his own. When he visits, he's either invited or he's going on an official visit to another head of state. And we compared two scenarios in which heads of state warrants were issued against heads of state. If you recall, Charles Taylor. Charles Taylor's warrant was issued and under seal initially, and the president of Ghana was requested to execute it. And of course he wouldn't do it. And it was, sorry, it was later that Charles Taylor was arrested. In the case of Milosevic, you found that it was an open warrant, but there was this process of isolation going on until in the end, he was completely isolated, arrested, and surrendered to the former International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia. These things will take time. You know, with respect to Bashir, it will take time. But I believe that Bashir's destiny is the ICC.
Hi, Mrs. Bensouda. I'm James Nunez. I'm a first-year student here. Now, I'm just wondering, does the ICC play an active role in trying to convince nations to accept its jurisdiction? And secondly, how can nations be convinced? I mean, what benefits would there be for, say, the United States to sign up?
ICC itself doesn't go out to countries, governments, and convince them. But there is the CICC, you know, which is a coalition of NGOs, I think over 2,000 NGOs, who have, you know, made it their responsibility to approach states and talk to states and try to convince them and show them what are the benefits of becoming a state party to the Rome Statute. Also, the president of the court, I must say, do visits sometimes some states who are contemplating to ratify or who would want to know more about the court and talks to them about joining the ICC.
In fact, yesterday, Mrs. Bensouda was involved in a roundtable organised with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, AusAid, and the organisers of the conference in Sydney that she's been participating at, with representatives of states from the South Pacific and Southeast Asia, some of whom are non-states parties, and part of the exercise was to encourage them to think about ratification. Yeah. So those sorts of activities go on, yeah. Don't they? Yeah. All right, let's have another question. This gentleman, please. No, this one. Yeah.
My name is Khaled Osman. I'm the editor-in-chief for the Africa Migrant. I have few questions for you after the lecture, but I will make it easy. I will shoot two now. First, it's a great honor for Africa and for you to succeed Luis Moreno Cambo. And it's also a great pleasure for us Sudanese to meet you here in Melbourne. My question is that you as an African woman, and that the African Union endorsed your candidacy, will this change the relationship between the court and Africa? Mm-hmm. And how can we bridge the gap between pan-Africanism and global justice? This is my first question. The second one is, the Middle East is also another dilemma. You know the great divide between Islamic thoughts and global justice is another example of conflict. Mm-hmm. What are the court plans for Syria while you are struggling with Lebanon? Thank you.
Let me just take your last question first. Syria, we don't have jurisdiction. Syria has not signed or ratified the Rome Statute. Therefore, we cannot go there. If we had a referral from the UN Security Council, we would be able to go. But I don't know whether that will come. So we don't have jurisdiction. I think your first question about bridging the gap between ICC and Africa. First of all, I want to say this. You know, it may appear that there is this lack of cooperation from Africa towards the ICC. But to tell you in reality, over 50% of our requests for assistance go to African countries. And I think about 85% of those requests are positive. They come back. So individual African countries are cooperating with the ICC and also very well. But one of the priority areas that I have is also to see how Africa as a region can work better with the ICC. And all of the principals of the court are working on that currently. In fact, in the last AU summit, I was invited to go, and I attended, we are exploring ways in which this cooperation between ICC and Africa can even be better. As you know, currently all of our cases are in Africa, but that is another story I can give you. But yes, this is an area that the court is looking at seriously. In fact, even last year, we organized a working level meeting between the court and officials of the African Union. And we will take it further. We'll take it further.
Thanks very much. My name is Ryan Rosario, and I congratulate you also on your appointment, and I enjoyed the talk a lot. Could I just find out, how do you approach the issue of complementarity when, say, there's a referral from the Security Council, but the justice system is more like, say, the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where it's a different type of justice. How would the ICC approach that when there's an ongoing type of justice system, but not in the conventional type of court system?
You know, complementarity is one of the main principles of the Rome Statute system. And this means that either the national system is investigating or prosecuting the crimes that ICC is focusing on, or they have already investigated and prosecuted those same crimes. If that is the case, if they are investigating, then ICC takes a backseat, because ICC is a court of last resort. It is not a court of first instance. The idea behind this complementarity has always been to strengthen the national systems, because the primary responsibility of investigating and prosecuting always remains with the national state. This is how ICC was set up. And if they are doing something, I mentioned it when I talked about all these parties that are involved in the conflict in Iraq. This is the system. If they are doing it, then ICC will not come in unless those proceedings or whatever they are doing is not genuine. When a state is unable and unwilling or unwilling to prosecute these crimes, then ICC comes in. And already we have this example of Libya. It's not yet concluded, but Libya, we issued the warrants against Muammar Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam, and el-Sanusi. And when Saif al-Islam was arrested, Libya claims that they are going to investigate and prosecute. Now we need to see, you know, what the judges are actually looking into. They've sent them questions to answer certain, to make them determine, to know, to have more information on what exactly Libya is doing and what is their capacity. I think they've just responded to those questions. But this is the system. You know, if a state says that they will do it, the ICC will have to wait to see what kind of proceedings they are doing.
Okay, let's take another one from up the back, and then we'll move to other parts of the room.
Just following on, my name is Alexander. I'm a recent graduate of the law school here. Following on from your answer there on complementarity, how does the principle of complementarity, in your view, square up with good faith amnesties for that are put in place as part of national reunification? Or so, for instance, Judge Garzón in Spain was recently prosecuted for, in part because he was reopening an investigation into Franco crimes that had supposedly been closed off by an amnesty. So if there were, say, a bona fide amnesty, would the ICC still investigate, or would you consider your jurisdiction closed off under the principle of complementarity?
Well, as you know, there is no amnesty for ICC crimes, at least for us. But we are not insensitive to national efforts like that, provided it's not our target. And I will give you the example of Uganda. Uganda, when we went after the Lord's Resistance Army and identified the five commanders of the Lord's Resistance Army, we actually encouraged, because then there was an amnesty law for Uganda in place. So we sort of encourage that those who have not been indicted by the ICC should come out of the bush and take the amnesty and see how they can, you know, negotiate with the Uganda government. So I think that is an example just to show you that we went after those we thought bore the greatest responsibility for the crimes. We indicted them, and those whom we did not target, we encouraged that, you know, deal with it at the national level.
Hi, my name's Nick. I'm a student at the law school. And thanks for speaking to us tonight. But I was wondering, as prosecutor, would you pursue a case that you feel may or know may politically harm the court and its future prospects?
The court cannot have political considerations for deciding to take a case or not. If we do that, we will kill the court. That is why, as prosecutor, I will continue the tradition that is, or not the tradition, the mandate, which is that you go with your evidence. If your evidence leads you to X, that is what where your evidence has led you. You go after the person. But if we start saying that I shouldn't do this because this is what will happen to the, then I think that is what is going to harm the court. You know, we have to operate strictly within our legal limits.
Let's take this lady here. You. No, just two behind you. We'll come to you soon. Your turn will come.
Hello, my name's Margot Harris. I'm a barrister here in Melbourne. I'm wondering that with the benefit of 10 years of operation of the statute, whether you have a wish list as to amendments you'd like to make to improve the efficiency of the court or its ability to enforce.
Mm-hmm. last year, we had the 10-year review conference in Kampala, and I think this was an opportunity to suggest whether there should be amendments to the statute. And what we decided is that at least let us allow the court to have a full judicial cycle, you know, and probably after that we can think of what has worked well, what can be improved, what can we propose for amendment. But this was a decision that was just taken just last year that let the
My name is Adiba, and I'm presenting the Syrian Orthodox community. Thank you, and you know, to have you here in Melbourne, and I'll come back. I'm going to rephrase the question which someone just asked before about politics. How much influence the U.S. had on ICC?
None.
None?
None.
Is that 100%?
That is none. No influence.
Well, it doesn't. With all my respect, but I think all or majority of ICC decision it's because of the influence of the USS and the main financer, which what? Is unfortunate. The other question is, what about the NATO? Can you?
Let me just tell you about financing. US does not finance the ICC at all.
Indirect.
Yes.
Thank you.
But go ahead.
What about NATO? Can you prosecute collectively?
Mm-hmm.
What they're doing in Afghanistan and what they did in Libya and other countries?
Yeah, NATO, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. If crimes, what we are doing now, right now, is we are collecting information regarding the alleged crimes that took place in Libya for this period. And we have not made any decision yet because we don't know yet. There is a commission of inquiry that is taking place that is collecting information also regarding the alleged crimes by NATO. We're looking at it. But if it is, with regards, as you know, maybe I should say this, you know, the persons who we charge are the persons who bear the greatest responsibility for crimes. And those crimes should be war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, where we have jurisdiction. So all of these things will be taken into consideration. And we will see. But we are collecting information. Yeah.
Just going to have one final question, and I'm going to give it to you because you've been so persistent, and you'll accuse me of not giving you a fair go. And
thank you very much.
for the opportunity. Darfur Australia Network's been very strategic. There are 30 people spread all around the room, all with their hands up, so he can't miss some of us.
Thank you very much. My name is Abdulhadi Matar. I'm from Sudan, Darfur, Western Sudan. I have a very little question about gravity. Because there are a lot of crimes in Sudan, especially in Nuba Mountains. Now there are crimes are committed from for more than 6 months, and there are a lot of reports telling that they are above the threshold of this gravity. Yes. Until now, there isn't any investigation made about those crimes. Will you try to do any investigation about the crimes committed at Nuba Mountain and Blue Nile in Sudan? Or yes, you will be waiting for the for any other country, because Sudan is not part of Rome status.
Yeah. Yeah.
So will you do an investigation or not?
Yeah.
Thank you.
As you know, our investigations in Darfur, in fact, we're investigating in Darfur.
Yeah.
Our investigations have not stopped. If you recall, just recently, we have issued another arrest warrant against Hussein. So we continue. The unfortunate thing is that we are issuing the warrants, we are asking for warrants to issue, and it is not happening. Sudan is one of, Darfur is one of our challenging situations that we are investigating. Because as you know, we are having to investigate Darfur without going to Darfur, you know, yeah. Yeah, no, but that is where our jurisdiction is. No, the UN Security Council resolution referring the case to the ICC referred the situation of Darfur to the ICC.
To all those disappointed people with your hands up, I apologise, except that, well, it's a qualified apology. 45 minutes of question and answer is pretty impressive, and at some point we have to stop it. So thanks very much for your generosity in time and effort to take those questions so seriously, Mrs. Bensouda. We really appreciate it. All the experts, that is the public relations media advisor experts, tell you that Friday night is the worst time for a public lecture. You don't hold a public lecture on a Friday night because no one will come, or the numbers will be reduced. It is quite an extraordinary thing to see 350 people here. I didn't count you by head, by the way, approximately, on a Friday evening. And that surely tells us something about the subject matter and the speaker that so many people are keen to be here. I think we also see reflected in the questions how much interest, how much hope, how many expectations there are resting on the success of this International Criminal Court and the international criminal justice system at which it takes its central role. So we're deeply indebted to you. I can't call you Mrs. Bensouda when I'm talking to you. About you, I think I can, but when I'm talking to you, Fatou, for being prepared to add 24 extra hours to your Australian itinerary and to come and be with us and to talk about the court and to show so much of your passion and commitment to the ideals of justice. That's one of the reasons why we're excited with you about your election to the top job. But it will be a tough one, won't it? It's one thing to be deputy prosecutor. When you stamp up at the end of June to be the main person, then you will be criticised left, right and centre. You'll be criticised about the country situations that you are focusing on, and you'll be criticised for the ones you're not focusing on. You'll be criticised for the individuals you choose to seek approval from the pretrial chamber for the issuance of arrest warrants against, and you'll be criticised for the ones you chose not to, for whatever reason. And a lot of people won't understand the limitations to the court's jurisdiction, but either way, you'll be the subject of intense criticism. Well, it's a great thing that you're so tough. This is not Mrs. Bensouda's first visit to Melbourne. She was here in 2008. And On that occasion, when she gave a public lecture here at the law school as well, she spent some time during the afternoon visiting the Honourable Malcolm Fraser, former Prime Minister. And I asked him afterwards, how was it meeting Mrs. Bensouda? Excellent. She's the first person I've met, I'm quoting him, he's not here, but I'm sure he'd approve, who was tougher on Thabo and Becky than I was. And that is impressive coming from an African person. Well, this toughness is going to be really, really important. But when you made your call to the audience for supporters, I'm sure there are many people who do want to stand with you, even if it's from the other side of the world, in support of your endeavours, because there is much at stake in relation to them. I will. I'll put my hand up. But I know that I'm not alone, because there are many people in the room whose faces I recognise. I'm sure there are many others who I don't know yet who are true supporters of the court. I will acknowledge the presence of one of them in particular, and that's Bill Pace, who is the convener of the Coalition for the International Criminal Court, also participating at the same conference in Sydney. I was looking at you, Jonathan, wondering where is he, but I see him. Bill has done an extraordinary job at drawing together 2,500 NGOs from all around the world to work hard to support the institution, the International Criminal Court. It's people like that that have made it the institution it is and is becoming. And thanks very much for your efforts, Bill. For the others in the room, some of the next generation who will become the future leaders you talked about, mm-hmm. I'm sure they will also join you in supporting your great work. All the very best to you, Fatou, and thank you again for coming to be with us. I have just a small gift which I would like to present on behalf of the law school and the Brett family to thank you very much for coming to deliver this Peter Brett Memorial Oration. Thank you very much. Thank you.